let's get started. So today we are talking about proof of reserve, and we're talking about it in terms of the cryptocurrency security standard. That is C4's standard that's been around for a while, but we're going to delve into the details today. So I'm Jessica Levesque. I'm the executive director at C4, and we have three of our CCSS committee members today. So let's go around and introduce ourselves. Michael, do you want to start?
Sure. Hi, my name is Michael Perklin. I helped found C4 back in 2014 and was a primary contributor to the original draft of the cryptocurrency security standard that was launched in 2014, the same year, yes. It's a privilege to be here talking about this this standard and what it means in the context of the last few weeks' events.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to talk about the last couple of weeks. Somebody yesterday said the last week has been a year, I think. Was that you, Michael?
Yes, but it was actually a quote that I heard Josh say, and I thought it was a great one. The last week has been a very long year.
Yes, that's a good one. All right, now, Josh, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Josh, also one of the co-founders of C4, also helped write the initial cryptocurrency security standard, and currently making blockchain games over at Slow Ninja. Happy to be here too. Times like this, you know, I'm glad we have a standard, but it's about how do we help both businesses protect themselves and consumers protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Jameson.
Hi, I'm Jameson, co-founder, CTO of Casa. I've spent the past 8 years working on self-custody solutions, was originally employed by one of the companies that helped launch the standard back in the day.
All right, awesome. So let's start by talking about what the standard is on a high level, and then we'll get into proof of reserve. So Josh, do you want to explain what the standard is, and then Michael explain what proof of reserve specifically is?
All right, I've been given a task. Excellent. So the cryptocurrency security standard was started as a way to fill in some gaps. There's obviously already standards out there around information system security, around securing businesses, both virtually and physically. But those standards didn't necessarily take the immutable nature of blockchain technology into account. They didn't really take into account the fact that there's no undo in this space. So when things are stolen, they're gone. And there's certain things that we need to care just a little bit more about. So we wrote this standard as a way of filling in those gaps and complementing those established standards that already exist. And we wrote it both to give businesses a way of helping to define their own infrastructure, helping to define their own practices and what they need to do to either secure their own funds or the funds of others, as well as giving others looking at a business, be them consumers or say insurers or even business partners, to say, you know, what kind of standards do you meet internally? If we're all just doing something ad hoc, then it's really hard to compare how one business is doing to another. So by creating the standard, it allows us to understand at a glance of whether or not two businesses are comparable in their security practices and their security hygiene, or if there's potentially things that could be improved upon.
Great, great summary, Josh. C4 was founded just for measurements and standards. We needed a way to measure whether someone knew about Bitcoin or did not, and that became the CBP credential. But when it came to security, as Josh pointed out, there was a lot of disagreement between whether a company was performing adequate security steps or not. So the CCSS is a measurement stick that you can apply to any system that deals with cryptographic private keys in order to know whether it is doing it in a secure way or not. And when Joshua and I started this project back in 2014, we enlisted the help of a lot of industry titans. We had input from BitGo, we had input from blockchain.com, we had input from a lot of companies, the principal security engineers at each of these organizations, including Jameson himself, contributed a lot of insight into the hacks that had occurred to date at the time. Proof of reserves actually came from a control that was contemplated after the downfall of MT-GOX. We saw that MT-GOX, they claimed to have so many Bitcoin, but in reality, they had far fewer. And at the time, the idea of publishing a proof of your reserves was talked about often as a way to at least give some credibility to the exchanges that that were operating under full reserves. In short, the proof of reserve requirement means that the exchange either publishes enough information to allow anybody to know, yes, they do have one-to-one Bitcoin backing from what they say they do, or it allows them to publish other information about their system so that you don't need to trust their word. You don't need to read a report from them. They've published enough information so that you can check on the blockchain itself, count up how many Bitcoins they truly have, and know whether they are operating a fully solvent system or an insolvent system. So that's what the proof of reserve requirement is. Jameson, did you have anything to add that I may have missed?
Well, it gets a bit tricky, right? So, you know, there is still an element of trust. You know, we're adding in some cryptographic proof, but, you know, these proofs are essentially additional attestations to complement, you know, some other audit that has been performed, you know, preferably by a reputable third-party accounting firm or something. And, you know, I think one of the things that makes this contentious or gets people upset is the belief that it's a perfect control. I would argue, you know, almost none of these controls are, you know, perfect silver bullets, but rather you've got to step back and you have to look at the entire system of controls and rules that comprise the different tiers of the standard and say, you know, this is all relative. And so I guess what we're going to be trying to make the case for is that it is better to have something than nothing.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The one detail about the standard is that it's in three levels. Level one being, you know, secure, good controls. Level three being, we like to use the term a little bit more on the paranoid side of things, and extremely difficult. If you meet any of those, one, two, or three, you've still done a great job protecting your business. On proof of reserve, the third level, that final, that like greatest level of security, the ideal was that the system that was being assessed didn't even need proof of reserves because the control was fundamentally in the user's hands, and they could verify at a glance what was there.
Good point, so that you bring up the,
you know, even, sorry. Even early, oh no, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's a good point that you brought up the three different levels. A lot of the controls in the CCSS have three different levels, being very good, over the top, and as Josh used the word, paranoid. Even just level one of the cryptocurrency security standard is damn secure. Every company who achieves level one should be very proud of what they've accomplished. When it comes specifically to the proof of reserves requirement, under the CCSS, this is aspect number 2.03.1. There are three levels of proof of reserve, level one, level two, and level three. The first level is a company has published a proof of reserve report, period. That's it. If you've published a proof of reserve, that's great. That's more than what a lot of companies are doing. Indeed, it was more than what FTX did. But as Jameson rightly pointed out, it still does command a little bit of trust. How do you know that that the company that is publishing this, that they're being truthful? Who knows if they've left some information out? So level one is publishing a proof. Level two is publishing regular proofs on a regular schedule. This is helpful because now you can see a track record of being committed to this process. Level three, though, is the most interesting to me, because with level three, the system publishes enough information in an automated way so that you don't need to trust a report written by a person. You can independently verify the reserves on their own. One example of what this could look like is, let's say that there is an exchange, a custodial exchange, where anybody around the world can deposit their Bitcoin so that they can now trade on that exchange. If every user that deposits Bitcoin is given a unique address, so Jameson's account gets address A, Josh's account gets address B, and Jessica's account gets address three. I'm just realizing all three of your names begin with J. That leaves me the odd man out. If everybody has their own unique address and everybody is depositing into their own unique address, but all those addresses are controlled by the exchange, what the exchange could do once per month, or maybe even once per evening on an automated basis, they can publish a list of every single deposit address for all of their accounts, alongside some unique but hidden identifier. A, B, C, D, whatever could be Jessica's account ID. So obviously we don't see Jessica's name. We don't see Jessica's email address or any other personally identifiable details, but we can see that this exchange has these tens of thousands of Bitcoin addresses. And now anybody can take this list, they can look on chain, they can count up how many Bitcoins are in control of all these addresses and know precisely how many coins are in control of that exchange. With a system like that, it becomes trivial for anybody to verify rather than trust. Now, of course, you still have to trust that they are including all of the addresses in that list and they're not missing any, but Jessica, Joshua, and Jameson would all have the freedom to look at that list, control F, find on their computer, to look for their own address and see, oh, yep, there's mine. And yes, that is how many Bitcoins I have in that exchange. And if all of us are independently verifying just our own row, it's very likely that we can trust the document in its entirety.
Yeah, and I think this idea of providing assurance to the public is what brought us here today, because we have a situation right now where many people trusted a company and it didn't work out for them. And when we're talking about blockchain technology and we're talking about Bitcoin, what we're really talking about is a public way to verify information. Like, you can verify on a blockchain using a blockchain explorer if the money you sent to somebody has arrived or not, and if it's moved or not. So we should, in theory, be able to monitor all of this, maybe not whose money it is, but at least to be able to see. If I sent you Bitcoin last week, Michael, and I know what address I sent it to, I can look that up and see. And if you say you're just holding it for me for a couple weeks and I look and it's gone, then right away I know that there's something amiss and that maybe I shouldn't have trusted you with my Bitcoin. So we're in this situation now where there's a company that has made some mistakes, shall we say, it appears. Does anyone want to give a rundown on what it is that is happening right now that has everybody kind of not sleeping and maybe going a bit crazy if you've had your money on an exchange or you've got somebody else holding it right now?
I volunteered Jameson after writing a very well researched blog about this very topic.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is history repeat itself. The repetitions are never exactly the same. There's always a lot of variation.
The repetitions are always different.
Yes, history rhymes. It doesn't perfectly repeat. But the point being that this is at least the 20-something or 30-something-ish exchange over the past decade that has been shown to be operating under a fractional reserve. And, you know, there are a myriad of reasons as to why a custodial entity may end up operating as a fractional reserve. Some of them, such as lenders, are actually meant to do that. But generally, we consider, you know, spot market exchanges should be optimally operating at a one-to-one reserve and should not be moving client funds around without the explicit authorization of the user that is supposed to own those. So really what has happened is, due to malfeasance or accidents or who knows what, because it's going to take a long time to figure out exactly, you know, what happened, it turned out there was a mismatch between the believed number of assets on FTX and the actual amount of assets. And so, you know, eventually, you know, this comes to light when a company reaches such a low reserve that they can no longer even continue to process requests to withdraw assets, and essentially have to throw up their hands, shut down, reorganize, go through bankruptcy, and so on and so forth. And you know, would proof of reserves have prevented this? You know, that's where the topic becomes really questionable, because, you know, proof of reserves, or really any type of auditing, it doesn't really change your security model of, you know, how you're operating at any point in time. What it's really showing is that, you know, up until the point at which the audit happened, it looks like everything is going well, and that there have been, you know, no misappropriations of funds. So, you know, if FTX had either more regular audits and they covered everything, perhaps this would have been found out sooner. It does seem like they have probably been operating, you know, as a fractional reserve exchange for quite a while. It's unclear how far back that goes. But sort of going back to one of the original points with the nature of trust here, you're still relying upon the audit to actually cover everything. And at least from some of the things that I've heard so far, some of the information that has come out, it looks like there may have been audits, but the audits did not actually, you know, cover everything, because just the expansive nature of all of the organizations and their relationships in this case made it a lot easier, I guess, to hide exactly what was going around with, like, the left hand paying the right hand and so on and so forth. So we certainly cannot claim that you know, this would have prevented anyone from losing money, but it might have, you know, given people a signal a lot earlier that there was something wrong.
Yeah, that scope is certainly a big issue. Audits are expensive, and, you know, it's easy, not only expensive in costs, but in time and resources. If you're trying to run a business and you're always focused on audit, it can be very difficult to move forward. So you kind of want to, you know, get it done and get it out the door. And I can appreciate why that would be the case. It does, you know, there's some trust there on the auditors that they're, you know, looking for the right things. One thing that we've seen many times over the years, and Gox is an example of this. If you're Canadian or, you know, watch Netflix, you might be familiar with Quadriga, which is arguably an example of this as well. And I think here, it sounds like there might be some examples of this happening here. In many cases, this, it's not the only piece, but sometimes it's this one event or several small events in which in Gox, it was a loss, a theft of coins. And then how do we get those coins back? In Quadriga, it was the same thing. There was quite a bit of Ethereum, I believe, locked up in a smart contract, a multi-sig smart contract, that they could just never get it back. In FTX, you know, again, we don't know the exact details of what's taken place here, but given the last 8 months, it's fair to assume, you know, was there some UST sitting around in that exchange that was no more? You know, there's been quite a few collapses, both from lenders and borrowers all over the industry. If you were kind of holding the paper Bitcoin, which, you know, maybe we'll get into that term in a second, you start to think, how do I fix this? And it's an easy way to justify then horrible things happening, which are completely fraudulent and just disgusting in hindsight. But at a certain point, it's like, oh, it's a bit of a gamble. I can fix this. It's just going to take one or two trades, and then we'll be fine. We'll be back in. Now, you know, if we're talking about timing a proof of reserves, maybe it's not necessarily about, you know, a yearly or quarterly thing. Maybe it's a situational thing, whereas the industry, we have to go, you know what, some big things just happened. We need to know who's actually whole right now.
I think that's an interesting point in terms of who needs to be demanding that the standards that have been created or these options to look in and like actually look into something are happening. Because if we know that these options exist, but there's been nothing that has kind of forced these companies to do that, then I think we're failing as end users and as people partnering with these companies and whatnot, because we, as a society, we keep using these services without knowing that they're safe. And like you were just saying, it keeps on happening. This is not just one time and we're like, oh, shame on us. Now we know better. It's like, at what point are people going to say, okay, I'm going to stop using systems that don't have, haven't at least attempted to prove that they're doing what they're saying?
There's an interesting connection here that I've noticed in a few breaches and in a few pain points when dealing with cryptocurrency. And I think it's useful to shine a light on it here. We know that Bitcoin is a decentralized monetary system. Completely decentralized, has no controllers, works regardless of borders. One thing I've noticed is whenever you are interfacing with a decentralized system by using some kind of a centralized system, in the case of FTX, they were a centralized company-controlled exchange, company-controlled system that interfaced with Bitcoin. It's always that boundary between the decentralized world and the centralized world. That boundary causes the most friction, the most complication, the most security issues, and the most losses for victims. And it comes into play when, for example, a proof of reserves. Well, when you're dealing with a decentralized system, I can just look it up on chain on my own, and I don't need to trust someone. But if it's a centralized company holding all these reserves, well, now I need to trust them. When it comes to cybersecurity and protecting coins, when in a purely decentralized world, it becomes a lot easier when each decentralized entity controls their own keys. But when you are dealing with a centralized middleman, now you need to trust that they are holding their keys. And because they're signing so many more times than a normal average user would, because they're signing on behalf of thousands or tens of thousands or millions of users, now cybersecurity becomes more difficult for them. When it comes to PII, personal information, and KYC rules, again, if we're all dealing on our own in a decentralized world, it's easy. But when you're doing it through a centralized intermediary, it becomes hard. I believe, and I don't know if I'm right about this, and I may not know before my time is done here on this planet. I believe that as long as we are existing in that transitionary period, when we are moving from the older centralized middleman focused world into this new decentralized world where there are no middlemen, that crossover period that we find ourselves in today is going to be rife with all these types of issues. And I dream of the day when all of our children will be able to wake up and use these decentralized systems without even questioning about using a centralized system. Kevin O'Leary was a proponent of FTX. He advertised for FTX. And there's a pretty shocking quote from him saying, "Oh, I absolutely trust FTX. Sam Bankman-Fried's parents were regulators. So there's no other entity that I would trust more than FTX because of that." So he appeals to authority and he appeals to a need for trust. That makes sense when you're dealing with companies and corporations. But again, it it underscores the decentralized world that we're building, where we don't have to rely on people's appeals to authority or people's vouchers for trust.
But in the meantime, we have a security state.
That's right. Sorry for waxing philosophical on you all.
Well, no, I think you've got a group of people here who agree with what you're saying. What we're trying to do is solve the problem that exists in the meantime until there aren't people that are using these systems. For now, there are lots of people and billions of dollars worth being kept through these companies that have the keys, hopefully, to the coins. And so in the meantime, while we get to this ideal world that we all want to be in, we do have to find a way to make it safer. And that is, like you said, where the CCSS comes into play.
Yeah. If you don't think that you have good enough security with your system, whether you are a person or you are a company or whatever in between, the CCSS is a perfect measuring stick to gauge just how secure you are. So if you haven't taken a look at it, I definitely encourage you to do it. I personally believe that if FTX had adhered to the principles in the CCSS, the proof of reserve being only one of, I think, 38 different controls that are outlined there, we would be talking about much different things today than we are today.
Yeah, I mean, I think to kind of piggyback on top of that, one important aspect to point out of quite a few of these controls is that, you know, we're not only creating a system that is resistant to external attackers, it's also meant to make the system resistant against internal attackers. And based upon the knowledge that we have thus far of what occurred at FTX, it appears like you could consider this a type of insider attack where there were only a handful of privileged employees who actually knew what was really going on with the crypto assets and with the accounting and finances of all of these interrelated entities. So, you know, I think this is once again why some people can go out and make these straw man arguments that, like, well, you know, the company itself could be completely corrupt and everybody could be colluding with each other and create, you know, fraudulent audit reports and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's always possible, but it's just a question of, you know, how much effort is there that you would have to put in to do that. So, you know, if you're trying to evaluate one of these custodians and you don't see any public audits or proofs published, you know, that's kind of a red flag. If you see maybe one a year, then that at least shows that they put some effort into it. If they're doing it even more frequently, I think we've seen some recently say that they're going to be doing either weekly or bi-weekly reports, you know, that's even better. And then, as Michael said, you know, the optimal form of proofs would be essentially a real-time system where you can look at, you know, the state of the blockchain and your assets without even relying upon the company themselves to publish any additional information. And so this is all just about integrity and, you know, showing that the system has a higher level of integrity and, you know, trustworthiness. It does not, of course, show that those funds can't be moved without your consent. You know, if not your keys, not your coins, definitely still applies. But you know, this several controls out of the dozens of controls in the system is just one more way of shoring up the entire system that is meant to be, you know, protecting these crypto assets.
I've read a bunch of people online being very critical of the concept of proof of reserves. Some statements that I've read were something along the lines of, proof of reserves is BS, without any explanation of why. Or proof of reserves is too easily gameable. Maybe it would be a useful exercise to sort of argue on the other side and talk about this one point, proof of reserves, critically from the opposing viewpoint, just to sort of tease out all sides of it?
Well, I think one place to start in that is kind of what Jameson was alluding to. First of all, it's a piece of the puzzle. It's not the entire piece of the puzzle. So you can say, yes, you know, we don't trust the auditor in this case. If we want to go that far, this is now like a multi-organizational scam to agree with. If we take the CCSS as all of its components, and the CCSS is about all of these different components coming together, a lot of it's also about managing the keys. So, you know, how are keys created? How are keys utilized? How does the wallet form? Is it a multi-sig? Is it, you know, an MPC system involving several different keys? Understanding the full key system of how these different pieces come together to actually authorize transactions. And then on the procedural side, understanding when a transaction is brought up, why it's brought up, how it's authorized, both from a business perspective, and then how is it executed with the different signatures required to actually bring it together. So you're understanding, okay, here's all the funds of this system. Here's all the different components. Here's how the keys all come together. And then proof of reserve becomes okay, let's prove that this is the actual system that we're looking at too. Let's understand, because you can show me a whole like theatrical performance of how keys are created and tell me all the procedures that are written in stone as to how you do it. But if we don't then follow it through the process to understand, and all of that specifically relates to these funds over here in this business, the proof of reserve kind of closes the loop on that. And you can argue, oh, well, you know, it's a point in time. Absolutely, it's a point in time, but it's a point in time that specifically proves, as far as the CCSS is concerned, that the assessment on that business's key systems actually relate to the funds that we're talking about. Now, if suddenly we find out that, you know, there's a backup of all the keys sitting inside the CEO's, you know, office that only he has access to, well, that's against the controls in the CCSS and change things completely.
Yeah, I've gone to quite a few conferences this fall and started just going up randomly talking to people who are from different custodial services. They don't know who I am. I just like bring it up, mention the CCSS. Many of them have heard of it. Some of them are really excited about going through the audit process, and some of them are not excited about it. They don't want anything to do with it, which scares me. But this past week I was there, and someone that I was talking to was like, oh yeah, I love that you're doing this. And they started talking about proof of reserves and how they are already doing this. And like, they were looking at the standard and saying, oh, we're doing this, so this wouldn't be a big deal. Oh yeah. And like literally going through it with me and saying like, oh yeah, we can't wait to have somebody check this out. And everything they said, they might not actually have it. We'll find out when they get audited. But as they were going through it, their response to it was very different than some responses I've had, where I'm thinking, okay, you probably don't have your, you know, ducks lined up, and that's why you don't want anyone to do it, versus the really positive people where I'm thinking, okay, like take notes, right? And that's what we want as end users, to find these companies that really do care about other people's money. They don't think that like, oh, it's just a couple $100 here and there. Like, they recognize that there are real people at the end of this who are being impacted by it. And those are the companies that I'm super excited to see go through this process, so that the rest of us know, if we want to trust somebody other than ourselves, who we can trust.
I love hearing that, Jessica. And it warms my heart to hear that there are many systems out there that are already accounting for the majority of the controls listed in the CCSS. Jameson said it, Josh said it, I said it, and you referenced it right here. An information system is like a chain, and a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. If you're too scared to put stress on that chain, maybe you know that there are some pretty weak links in that chain already. When we were putting together the first framework of the CCSS, way back in 2014, we outlined every single hack that we knew of to date, and we researched and investigated every single one of them to understand the root cause of all of them. And we talked with the people who were who either designed or maintained the systems at each of these companies or exchanges that lost funds due to these hacks. And we started grouping things together and organizing them, and it painted a very familiar picture. One of just a classical information system. Now, normally when people think of an information system, you think of the tech. And FTX's website, oh, it's just the website. Or you know, if you're using a hardware wallet, oh, it's just the hardware wallet. But that is only one small piece of the full chain, only one aspect of the information system. There's five categories of any information system. There's the hardware that you use, the software that you use. And again, most people erroneously think that these two are the information system, but they're just pieces. The hardware, the software. There are policies on, you know, thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that. Basically rules that should be followed when using this information system. There are procedures, the things that people do in order to comply with the policies. And then, of course, there are the people. How are they trained to use the system? Hardware, software, policies, procedures, and people training. Only if all five of those are covered will you ever have any chance at having a truly secure system. An example that I love to use is, it doesn't matter how long or complex your password is, how many M of N treasures you are using. If you take the password for that, or the backup seed for that, and you write it down on a post-it note and stick it to the side of your monitor, there's no way that that is going to be a secure system, even if you've got some like tactical grade links in that chain. One of those is a small paper slip. You need to worry about all of them, not just the tech, but how you as a human interact with it. And the CCSS took that into account when devising the 38 controls grouped into those five categories.
Yeah, and I think in terms of like these five pieces that you're talking about, if you take any one out, there becomes a weakness to it. And for some of us that aren't security professionals, when we look at something like the standard, we might be able to say like, oh, here are some things I should or shouldn't be doing, or here's what I want to look at if I'm using a custodian. But if you have a trusted expert going in and looking like these auditors are and giving information, you know, they're seeing what's happening. They know what to look for. It creates this additional a way for people like me who aren't super technical to be able to see, okay, somebody else is technical. They're checking it. Does this mean it's 100% not going to have any issues? Of course not. But it's better than nothing, I think is the point. So like what we've been talking about is like self-sovereignty, being able to do this yourself. It's the best way to do it. For now, when we're not there yet, there are these baby steps and there are these things along the way that we can do to make things a little bit safer and feel more secure about it, which is why all of us are on this call and why we are encouraging the rest of the industry, the space, to be doing the same thing, where we should be advocating for these companies that are doing things correct. And for everyone watching, you'll be seeing in the next month, maybe sooner, some companies that are at least one that have been undergoing the audit, and they'll be releasing that information soon. So there are actually companies starting to go through this already, which I think is really exciting for those of us who want to have multiple options of what to do with our crypto. With that being said, I do think that it'd be interesting to look at, like, I think we talked a little bit about FTX in terms of like what the proof of reserve would have done, maybe, or like if they had gone through this. But if we were to look at a company like FTX and we were to say like, this is a point in time audit, right? So like the proof of reserve, we don't look at it every single day. We could just look at it. What if we'd seen like a month ago? What if there'd been an audit a month ago and then things had changed now? What's the likelihood of something like a proof of reserve audit actually catching something? Do we have any idea?
In this case, I think it would have highlighted something very clearly, very early. The allegations are that FTX and Alameda, two separate companies, were commingling funds inappropriately. So this proof of reserve audit, simply publishing, here's a list of all FTX user balances. That alone would have been very difficult for FTX to publish, knowing that they had taken all of FTX user balances and given them to Alameda in order to trade. So that's one very easy flag that would have been waving early in the day. And ultimately, it took a Twitter army of people trying to identify the cold wallet of FTX that started to unravel this whole story. Because every exchange, especially an exchange that has, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars worth of deposits from users all around the world, they got to be storing that money somewhere, right? And people couldn't find where that money was stored. So yes, I think that kind of transparency from FTX showing here's where all of your user deposits are being stored, it would have immediately prevented the kind of grift that they have been getting away with for so long.
Do you guys think that this is going to change how people are going about using custodians? Like, do you think, like, I know somebody got an email from Gemini saying that all of the money on Gemini Earn is now paused or you can't withdraw it. Do you think that this is the time that people are going to learn from it? Or do you think we're going to be on a call like this again?
The cycles are not going to end. No. As a self-custody provider, obviously this has been very good for my business, not so good for exchanges. Anyone who knows how to look at on-chain metrics can see that there have been massive outflows from custodians over the past few weeks. But human nature is such that we quickly forget the tragedies of the past. Plus, this space is still tiny and growing, and so we will have new cohorts of entrants who they don't learn from history because they weren't around for it and they don't put in the effort to learn the history. So I think it will continue to happen, but it will also spur improvements. This is sort of the nature of cybersecurity. It's always a cat and mouse game. And just as the genesis of the security standard itself was born out of a dozen different major hacks and losses, this doesn't end. Every time a major incident like this happens, the folks in the security space do root cause analysis to understand, was there a best practice that could have been implemented that would have prevented this? And if so, is that best practice already a known best practice, or is it something new that we need to add to our sort of communal knowledge? Now, it seems like we have hit a sort of leveling off point there where nothing really completely novel has happened in a while, or at least like most of, I would say, the novel hacks and exploits that happen these days are generally like smart contract level issues. That is a, I will say, completely different problem that the security standard does not even attempt to address. There are other entities, organizations, communities, ecosystems that are attacking that because it's a multifaceted problem space on its own. But yeah, I mean, things will get better for a bit, and then they'll get worse, and then they'll get better. But, it's really about the trend. Is hopefully we keep learning, keep getting a little bit better. We'll still suffer setbacks, but I believe we need to continue to make this just a part of the culture of the space, because it's the same problem, I think, with like both privacy and security and other things that they require you to take on responsibility. The result of that is that because humans tend to prioritize convenience over everything else, you know, whenever there's a level of friction or work required for people, then we need to have some more innovative solutions at play to try to get people to put in the effort to do that. So, you know, one of those is pushing the standard forward, really getting trying to get more community pressure on various entities that are potential points of failures. You know, we don't want systemic risk to spread throughout the system because people are not following best practices. And the other one is what I've been doing for 8 years now, which is trying to lower the bar, really make it easier, improve the user experience for people to get into robust self-custody solutions. Because everything that we're really talking about here, while we are obviously proponents of it and we want to see greater adoption of it, even if every custodian out there was, you know, tier three certified, you know, top level security standard compliant, I would argue that it would still be better for, you know, the vast majority of people to self-custody rather than trust these various entities, because it still does put a level of systemic risk in the system just to have large amounts of wealth concentrated in small number of places.
Yeah, not to say something that would crumble our business model, but we all want people to be self-custodying, right? This is like the entire purpose. So it's strange probably if people are listening to this and thinking, wait, so you've created a standard that you eventually don't want to be used. But that is kind of the ultimate goal, is that eventually people will have the tools to be able to do this themselves. We just know that in this probably very long period in between that we need to find a way to make things safer. And I think a couple of the things that you were saying, Jameson, this culture and requiring how self-custodying requires responsibility. There's also that responsibility for the company's custodying that they need to be making different choices perhaps. And I think what you said is very true, that we need the community to kind of push things along to make a difference. If the community isn't, I'd say, advocating for there to be more proof of reserves, if the community isn't, I don't even want to use the word advocating, basically like forcing these companies into doing this, if they don't want to do it, then there needs to be someone that says like, hey, there are tons of people whose money you're holding on to and you don't seem to really care about that. Let's trace where this is going, kind of like what happened with FTX. We need people who are kind of going to champion this alongside us to make sure that we can make these changes, because the standard exists. It's just about getting it to be used.
Yeah, and I think it's important to work at this problem from both ends. Jameson mentioned that he has dedicated this chapter of his career to lowering the bar, making it easier for people to become self-custodians and have the self-sovereignty, all the knowledge and the tools necessary to do it on their own. C4 is actually coming at it from the opposite end of the candle. We're coming at it from the education angle. I'm a firm believer that in the same way that today everyone knows how to use passwords, everyone knows the obvious password hygiene gotchas, like don't use your pet's name, don't use your anniversary date or your mother's maiden name or things like that. Don't use those as passwords because that is bad. We do know to use longer passwords, use symbols in there, et cetera, et cetera. That has entered the public consciousness thanks to living with this technology for so long, living with passwords for long enough that it's just generally known what is good, what is bad when dealing with passwords. Private keys are a different animal. And Bitcoin has only been around for 11, 12 years now. Using these private keys is not yet part of the general social lexicon. But I believe that our children will be using private keys as ubiquitously in their lives as we use passwords today. I also believe that passwords will slowly be replaced, and it will become common to log into websites using a private key rather than using a password. But I'm not going to go down that route. What I think is great is that C4 is providing educational materials to train people on how to use private keys safely, to test them on whether or not they know the gotchas of using private keys. They understand the importance of what a mnemonic seed is and how to protect it. They understand through reading some of Jameson's educational material that he's put on lop.net, or how to choose the best way to back up your mnemonic seed, et cetera, et cetera. By raising people up through education and lowering the bar through easier to use tools, eventually I believe that the world will meet in the middle, and if not cross that bar, and it'll become as ubiquitous tomorrow as passwords are today.
I feel like after all the things we've been hearing that are so negative over the last week, I just like want to like bathe in those words of like positivity and like the future. It seems so lovely. I hope that your vision comes true, Michael. It's just like made me feel like kind of like warm and fuzzy after a week of hearing not so many positive things. So thank you for that. Okay. Anything else we want to say about proof of reserve or related to FTX right now? Anything that we're thinking in terms of like moving forward and how we're going to keep pushing this? So I think we've talked a little bit about this like double-pronged approach, but for those who are watching this stream right now, what, I guess, advice do any of you have for how they can help make a change, how they can help us move these two different things, self-sovereignty and at the same time, better choices for users because there's visibility into these different systems?
Well, I mean, at C4, we're certainly appreciative is that the space is always evolving, and sometimes events in the space force us to evolve a little quicker than maybe we were. Just yesterday, we had an incredible hour-long discussion with the CCSS committee to discuss this very topic of how does proof of reserve fit into the standard? Is there things that we need to be doing differently? An appreciation that it's both, you know, a technical exercise and an accounting exercise, and understanding kind of how those two can meet and merge. And the really what it boils down to is we didn't design the CCSS in 2014 and then, you know, we'll clap our hands, pat ourselves on the back and say, this is done. Excellent. Unfortunately, just like, you know, some of us learn as consumers, some of us also learn as professionals each day and have to make sure that the assumptions we make, the decisions we make, are not things that we simply sit on and go, okay, this is fact, this is all that needs to happen. We, as a committee, make sure that we discuss things that we once thought were as fact to make sure that it's still the best way forward, or we work to figure out what the best way forward is. I think those of us who are on the consumer side of things as well, we need to do that same thing. We might have a service and we've used that service for maybe a year, maybe 2 years, maybe 4 or 5 years we've used that service. And we just have a belief that, you know, they have our best interest at heart. But we're not necessarily open-minded to accept criticism of that service because they've always treated us well. We're too busy in our day. We don't want to question them, and we don't even know how to question them. There might be opportunities throughout your normal, you know, crypto exercises and say, is this company still the company that I think they are? Is this still a service that I'm happy with? You know, it's hard because things like crypto Twitter are filled with, you know, FUD, lies, nonsense, and just a whole bunch of crap. And some of it might be true and some of it might not be. It's really hard to parse that out. But, you know, take a step back from that sometimes and just say, what has this company lately done to show that they're still a good custodian of my assets? How have they treated me in support calls? How are things like my withdrawals? And then maybe just a little bit of where the hell did this company come from? And should I not be gently alarmed at even the story of how they came to fruition? I don't know. I don't know if that helps, but Godspeed.
I think that helps. That's interesting to hear.
I think my final thought would be this debacle, this repeated debacle, this rhyming debacle, as Jameson pointed out, once again shines a light on decentralized alternatives, where we could not see the balance book of FTX, where we could not glean anything beyond the opaque corporate walls around the fraud that was running rampant within that company. There are DeFi smart contracts that are completely readable on chain. There are systems where all reserves are displayed transparently for everyone to audit and see that every last shred of a coin is accounted for. And where you could trade on a centralized version like FTX, or you could trade on a decentralized version, it is worthwhile to investigate the decentralized alternatives, because by using these decentralized alternatives, you no longer need to transfer control of your funds to a company that might be rife with fraud. You no longer need to trust an entity to deal with your funds on your behalf and hope that when you request a withdrawal, they will choose to process it and give you your money back. DeFi transparent alternatives are a shining beacon to fight against the fraud that we've seen run rampant for all these years. And I'm excited for that light being shined on it.
Yeah, Jameson, I'd like to hear your closing thoughts. And also, you mentioned at the beginning that you've had a lot more people, companies, I'm not sure, reaching out to you right now for what CASA offers. And I'd be interested to hear if you can talk a little on that before we say goodbye.
Right. I mean, this is just the general trend that we see after every major exploit. We're seeing a lot of both old and new people sort of come out of the woodwork. Generally, it's like, well, I've had this in the back of my mind for a really long time, and now I'm scared enough to actually put in the work to look into improving my security posture. And yeah, that's one of the things about working in this space that is kind of a letdown, is that it seems like bad things have to happen in order for people to listen to us. I think I've heard a few people refer to it as sort of the Cassandra complex of working in cybersecurity, but that's just the name of the game. I'm hopeful that as we continue to kind of file down the rough edges around the usability issues in these spaces, that it won't require catastrophic losses to spur people into using better security systems. And so kind of to tack on to Michael's point, there's certainly a lot of interesting promise in being able to interact with truly decentralized systems. You're able to completely shed many classes of risk that are inherent to using third-party custodians, but once again, not a silver bullet. You're then taking on other classes of risks due to the new nature of this whole system, the best practices and security around those risks are kind of still in flux. They're being fleshed out through, once again, a series of hard lessons that are learned through various catastrophes. But it's not going to it's not going to stay the same forever, right? These are dynamic systems. And as long as there are dedicated people who are continually devoting their time and resources to improving these systems, then we can expect the trend to continue, that the usability and the security of the systems will improve. People will be able to operate within them more securely and more sovereignly, if that's a word. But, you know, with less and less trust on third parties, which is the reason why we're all here to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Let's not run away with fear, but use that fear to help guide us to make different choices and better decisions as we gain, you know, the information from the CCSS and who's going through this audit process, and be our own advocates for some better systems and more transparency in the system. So, Josh, Michael, Jameson, thank you so much. As always, you guys have so much important knowledge and insight to share with everyone. So I really appreciate you taking the time today to join to talk about proof of reserve. So thank you all for watching, and we will talk soon. Take care.